Hey Steele, how you doing?
Dave, I am fantastic.
Wow, that sounds like one of those NBA commercials. It's fantastic.
It's true. I like to drum my vowels out as well. Makes me feel alive.
Well, I'm excited today because I got a good friend here. I brought in, what do you want to go with, Rose or Rosie?
Oh, let's go with Rosie.
Okay, so we brought Rosie in. It's a little more friendly, a little less professional.
Rosie, hello.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Where are you joining us from today?
I am in Medford, Massachusetts.
Medford.
Said nice. It with my Boston accent I'm working on.
Is it wicked hot there right now?
No, it's been raining all day. It's real nice, though.
I think this might be the largest continent-spanning one we've done. Boston, Madison, and Phoenix.
We're representing lots of time zones.
Yeah, three of them. It's impressive.
Strong math there, Dave.
I did just graduate. I'm a doctor of nursing now, Steele, so I'm letting it show. I'm got a little more confidence for those sort of things.
Bravo. You're a doctor. You did it.
Yeah, the dream. But we got an exciting episode. We're going to talk about some vistas. We're going to go through a little bit of small talk, give you something to talk about at your next little get together. And then probably what I'm most excited about is we're going to talk a lot about Walden. I've never read any Thoreau whatsoever, but the other two people here have read a significant amount, and we're going to get into it. And we'll go through a little bit of music, some Unchained Melodies, and I think Rosie's bringing some book wisdom.
Yes. Yep. I'm very excited. I think, Rosie, your taste in literature so far is impeccable. I've been very impressed.
Oh, yes. I was an English literature major.
Oh.
In addition to religious studies for my undergrad, so I read a bit.
Yeah. We all make mistakes in our 20s, Rosie.
And some of us just keep reliving them well into our 30s. Is that accurate?
I wouldn't dare touch a PhD.
Yeah, I haven't learned my lesson with sunk costs yet. At some point, someone needs to educate me here, but I'm still hanging on.
Well, guys, I'm excited. We're going to talk vistas. I like to ask people questions in like a group setting, and I usually like to ask questions that people have a real hard time answering for whatever reason. One that I like to talk to people about is what's one of the most beautiful places that they've ever been, and people, I just did this the other day. People really can struggle with it, but there's so much beauty out there. I want to kind of hear what you guys have.
Is the struggle coming up with a place or being able to just pick one?
I think people hate to rank things. People don't want to say this is the prettiest. When I love to rank stuff, I love to say, yeah, that's the prettiest right there.
Do you do it with your triplets, Dave?
No, I do not. That's actually not appropriate. My wife told me, so I've been able to do better with that.
That's good. Well, I'll start off with the most beautiful place I've ever been. I have to say, so this is a place I had heard about before I went there, and the place I first heard it described was from our mutual friend Spencer, who's been a multiple-time guest on our podcast.
Yeah.
He told me that there was this wonderful heaven on earth place called Ticino, Switzerland. And Ticino was this canton in southern Switzerland right near the border with Italy. And he said it was incredible because it was the only place he had ever been. It has the Alps, so it has these beautiful rugged mountains. It also has these incredible, gorgeous mountain lakes that are just pristine and very clean, which is nice because that's what a lot of Switzerland is, Alps and mountains, you know, and lakes and Interlaken's like that. And it's gorgeous. It's famous. But he said that the trick with Ticino is because it's so close to Italy and kind of near the Mediterranean side, it's also got like palm trees and a sort of almost Mediterranean climate. So if you can imagine like the confluence of those three things, you've got palm trees, you've got these beautiful mountains, and then you've got these incredible crystal clear, crisp lakes. And it's not in Italy, so stuff is clean and things are efficient, and you're not getting constantly catcalled if you're a woman. So it's kind of nice.
That sounds beautiful. How did you experience it? What were you up to? Just on a little tripper?
Yeah, just on a tripper. I don't even know what that means, Dave. No, my ex-wife was from Geneva, from Switzerland. So after I graduated from college, the two of us went and spent a pretty awful summer in Switzerland. But I did see some beautiful places. And Ticino was, like, off the charts. There's these two towns we went to, Lugano and Gandria. And it's just kind of up in the mountains there. I went on a little run, you know, up through these back streets and this old kind of stone and brick buildings. And I had the greatest meal in my life there. It was just this very simple aglio olio and pepperoncini, just in this outdoor cafe right on this mountainside lake with palm trees a couple hundred feet away. It was just stunning.
But does that affect your feeling of the beauty? I guess it doesn't, because you're still able to appreciate the beauty, even though it may not have been the greatest moment of your life.
No, I mean, the moment that part of the trip was probably okay. I think overall things weren't going very well in our marriage and it didn't end well. But the place was beautiful and I think we both appreciated that, and it was one of the kind of happy moments of the summer. But yeah, it was gorgeous. I would go back in a heartbeat. Switzerland was stunning, and that place, those cities were just really spectacular. I really enjoyed it. We had paddle boats too. Little paddle boats you could take out in the lake.
Have you ever made it over there, Rosie?
Well, I actually have been debating doing a trip to Switzerland this October. We've been invited by some family members. That's where part of my family comes from. And so some of my aunts and uncles and my parents are doing I wouldn't call it a family reunion, but they're just going to check out Switzerland. And they've invited my husband and I. So we're trying to decide if it's in the budget right now.
I was going to ask, what you're debating it, what would be the con, really?
I know. Well, mainly it's the cost, because we'd be going with midlifers, past midlifers who are, you know, can travel a little more comfortably.
I see.
And we're just kind of fine to hop hostels and do whatever to cut costs, but we'd like to, you know, experience it with the family, and they're going to be doing it in their own way. So we're kind of, you know, debating whether or not we just do it on our own.
What I would recommend is, the two times I've been in Switzerland, my dad was paying for it. So that's ideally what you want to have happen. And it went really well.
Bring that up.
Yeah, no, yeah. Dave's dad might pay for you to go to Switzerland, Rosie. That's a good idea.
Just, yeah, write him an email, like a grant proposal, and just see what happens.
Will do.
What about you, Rosie? What's the most beautiful place you've ever been?
It was actually pretty easy for me to come up with. Place immediately came to mind, and it's the Spiral Jetty in the Great Salt Lake. It's kind of the Great Salt Lake in general, which I imagine there's a few listeners based in Utah, and I wonder if any of them have ever even, you know, really got to go see this Great Salt Lake, because I grew up there, and a lot of people, they just don't really care or don't really get the appeal, but I'm a lover of that lake. And the Spiral Jetty is this massive land art. It was created by an artist named Robert Smithson on the northern shore of the Great Salt Lake. And it's this like 1,500 foot long coil, 15 feet wide, and it winds counterclockwise in this spiral shape off into the shore of the Great Salt Lake. And it's just made of big black volcanic rock encrusted with salt crystals from the lake. And when you look out on it, you know, you're looking at this massive spiral, and then the Great Salt Lake just expands as far as you can see into the distance. I read that the Great Salt Lake, you know, put it to scale, it's the size of Delaware and Rhode Island. So you're looking out on it from this northern shore, and, you know, it's just as far as you can see, and it's just very still. I went there this summer on a rainy day, and there were light pinks and blue pastels and black rock with the salt crystals. It was just magical experience. You have to be careful when you go out to see it to not run out of gas. Like, there's always signs, you know, like you got to hit the last gas station and fill up the tank, because then you got to drive 40 miles to get to this land art and 40 miles back, you know, so you got to make sure you've got the tank. So kind of out there.
I remember reading about this, because it's a beautiful piece, really important. And I think he chose the location in part because of there's extra amount of kind of redness in the water just near it.
It's very red. It comes out as the pink, you know, when I saw it, just kind of a pastel, light pink, very beautiful. And in addition, you know, he chose, you know, I'm sure a lot of thought went into just having it at the Great Salt Lake. I don't know that he has a lot of Utah ties, but he had an interest in making art directly in the landscape. And the Great Salt Lake is just such an interesting place because it's this gigantic lake in the middle of the Great Basin Desert that no one can drink. One of my favorite authors called it the liquid lie of the West. Imagine all of the people who are, you know, making that trek, like California Gold Rush, and all of a sudden they see this water on the horizon and they get there and it's like eight times the, you know, saltiness of the ocean.
I've driven around the Salt Lake, but I've never like actually gone up to it. I think it's interesting. Like I love the desert in Arizona. I think it's beautiful. And I think some people would feel otherwise. And that's how I feel about the Salt Lake. I don't think that it's pretty. I mean, what's the draw for you? Why is it beautiful? What do you think?
Well, I do think that it's beautiful. I think it has to do with the real expanse that you can take in when looking out over that much still water. And it's different than looking out on a big lake in some ways, because the Great Salt Lake is so shallow. Like, I feel that it just has a different look, because you can walk out for hundreds and hundreds of yards and still be knee deep. So it's just like, it's just so still. And of course, there are beautiful mountains that you'll catch off in the horizon as well. So I think it's a beautiful place. Again, I think part of the attraction to the Spiral Jetty when you're really like taking in this vista and looking at it is this idea that it's also kind of an elusive or a mysterious place, because for at least half of my life, and I think half of my parents' lives, the Spiral Jetty was completely submerged in water.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never been to the jetty because for most of my life it's been underwater. And my sister-in-law from Milwaukee, she and my mother-in-law went out last year and visited the Spiral Jetty and took photographs of it. And I was so jealous because most of the time that I even lived in Utah, it was underwater. You couldn't go. Yeah, I mean, you could sort of see it. But
30 years, I think all like the 80s, 90s, and then sometime in the, I don't know, like around 2008, I think it, you know, emerged again. But so seeing a place like that, that, you know, it's not that it goes away, it's there, but you're just happy to have been in the right, you know, have the chance to see it. Stars aligned that you can be there when the water level was right.
That's neat. It sounds like it's, I think a lot of things you need to experience them to really understand their beauty. I just want to go walk into the Salt Lake now. Never knew. I didn't know you could walk like 100 yards out there and be knee deep. That sounds really neat.
And you could just float on it for 100 and more. I mean, you could just keep walking and it's so buoyant. You basically float anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You come out, your skin's dyed a little white.
Mm-hmm.
All salt.
All right. Next time I go to Utah, I'm in. Spiral Jetty. You convinced me. So I actually had trouble ranking my most beautiful place. I criticized people for not being able to pick one, but I have like six or seven I was thinking about. I'm going to pick one. It's called Marion Lake. It's in the Grand Tetons. And up by the Tetons, there's lots of really large, beautiful lakes. But this is just a very small lake. When I was 11 years old, we did a backpack trip with my brothers and my dad. And we did a little overnight hike. And we camped at Marion Lake. It's beautiful. Just this small, glassy lake that was reflecting the mountains in the background. My memory of it is me and my dad sitting at this lake with the reflection of the Tetons in it, and we're making pancakes on just this tiny backpack stove. Mm. And between us and the tent, these two moose come up and they're playing, but like they're kind of freaking me out because I'm 11 and they're just going at it horn to horn as we're making this breakfast sitting at the lake. And the Tetons are beautiful, but just to experience it while making delicious pancakes next to this glassy lake with moose fighting, it was beautiful.
Wow. So this is where is it? Close to Jackson?
Yeah, it's close to Jackson. We took a little thing up the mountain.
Funicular? Skytram?
Yeah, some type of tram we took. To me at the time, it felt like a super long hike, but I think I looked up the distance the other day and it was like 3 or 4 miles and there was no one else there. We were just camping by ourselves, but it's just this specific place where we got to see the reflection of the mountains in the water and have breakfast with some moose.
I love the Tetons. They're so unique how jagged, you know, I imagine there's, you said their reflection down on the water, and they're just very jagged, kind of Alps-like looking mountains compared to the Wasatch Front that I'm mostly exposed to. Like they just, the Wasatch don't have the jagged, you know, sharp edges that the Tetons do when you look at them.
And there's probably nothing I like better than hiking in the mountains and there's a meadow up high elevation with wildflowers in it. It just makes me so happy. And there, of course, this near this lake, there's a meadow as well. It's just beautiful.
Wildflowers.
So what I love about this, Dave, is all three of ours, in a way, had food connections to them. I don't know if you had a meal out there at the Great Salt Lake, Rosie, but I'm counting salt as a food. I had my pasta dish out in Ticino, and Dave, you had your pancakes there. So the most beautiful places had something to do with food for all of us.
And water, right?
Yeah, food and water. It's what you need.
That's happiness, is food and water.
It's life.
Well, thanks for sharing those with me. I just love to hear about beautiful places, and I want to go to the Spiral Jetty.
Me too.
Let's go, Steele. Let's just do it.
Let's stop doing this and drive. Okay.
Check your water level before you make the drive.
Let's do some small talk, Steele. We're just giving you some things to bring up in conversation so that you're ready. If you're in an awkward social situation, you can dig into your bag. You've got an interesting thing to say so that someone thinks you're smarter or funnier than you actually are. I use this all the time. People sometimes think I'm intelligent only because of this trick. And what makes for better small talk than standing around the water cooler and talking about a TV show? Rosie?
Well, I recently rewatched Lonesome Dove.
Oh, no.
Really the best TV miniseries ever made.
Yeah, it really is. It's so good.
Why is it so good? What is it about Lonesome Dove?
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a great mixture of action and friendship and beautiful landscapes and just the right amount of sadness to kind of pull at your heartstrings.
Yeah, you can't watch the full miniseries without crying at least once. You probably didn't cry more than once, but if you don't cry at least once, then you're just inhuman.
Yeah, if you don't, I think there's four episodes. If you don't cry in episode three, like, you're still human, but if you likely you will. And by episode four, you're definitely crying.
And it's exciting to talk to people about stuff that's really interesting, but I have an experience. I worked with a guy named Russ for a while as a nurse, and for about, I'd say, 2 to 3 months, every time I worked with him, I would go find him at some point during the work day, and I would share a story from Lonesome Dove with him. Oh. He'd never seen it, and it really lasted for about 2 or 3 months, because a story a day for 2 or 3 months, you can do it. It's Lonesome Dove. There's that much to share.
And, I mean, for me, the thing that makes Lonesome Dove so great is Robert Duvall. Gus?
Yes, Augustus.
I mean, Robert Duvall is my favorite actor of all time. I think I've seen probably 90% of every role he's ever played. And so I didn't actually see Lonesome Dove until maybe 5 years ago. I hadn't watched it. It was one of the last ones. And I was like, it's a TV show. Maybe it won't be that great. And then I was like, well, wait, it's Larry McMurtry. The novel's supposed to be awesome. And so I gave it a shot, and I was like, why didn't I watch this many, many times? It was so, so good.
Yeah.
It is so good. And it doesn't go from, I've read the novel. It's exactly the same as the novel. You don't even need to read the novel. You just need to watch the show because you get the feeling for Gus and for Call. It's Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones just playing maybe the greatest screen friendship we've ever seen. Just tugs at your heart. And these men somehow take a herd of cattle from South Texas up to Montana, and hearts break along the way. And there's a lot of visiting of prostitutes as well.
Right.
My sister-in-law recommended it to us. She said something along the lines of, they make it seem fun to be a prostitute in the Old West.
Yes.
That may be the show's greatest contribution to American society.
I've been debating whether or not, said maybe one of the best friendships or partnerships in Woodrow and Gus, but I kind of want to have a debate with someone on whether or not that one or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is a better partnership, but I don't want to have the debate because I don't have the answer either. I don't know what side I'd pick, but it's a similar friendship.
Yeah, doomed, Rosie, full of love.
Rosie, I have the answer right now. It's Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones. It, hands down, so good. Come on.
I don't think Dave shares your love of Robert Redford, Rosie. I'm afraid to...
No, everyone loves Robert Redford. And in that film, his hair is beautiful, and I wish I could have it, but I don't.
And he still had his original face in that first one, too. All the original parts, I think, were there.
Right.
So Small Talk, Lonesome Dove, greatest television miniseries ever. Steele, what do you got for us?
Okay, this is a fantastic story. I read this in The Guardian a few months ago. John Ronson, he writes about weird stuff all the time. But this story just totally captivated me. And it began in 2003. There was a criminal investigator named Dori Hadar. And he's leaving a D.C. jail at like 5 in the morning after visiting a client. And a flea market is setting up. And Dori Hadar was a crate digger. Like, he collects vinyl. So he sees that somebody's set up with like 15 boxes of records and nobody else is around. So he's like, awesome, this is great. And then he sees 38 records, albums, by this soul singer. And he's never heard of this guy. And he's a huge collector and he knows everything. And this guy was named Mingering Mike. Anybody heard of Mingering Mike before?
No.
No.
That's what Dory says. He's like, I've never heard of this guy. There's a record that's like his 1968 debut album called Sittin' by the Window. It's got a painting of a young man in a t-shirt, good-looking guy. And then he sees a Greatest Hits record, a Bruce Lee concept album, a ton of movie soundtracks, a live album from Paris. Some of them were still wrapped in their original cellophane with price tags and everything. And so Hadar's like, this guy looks interesting. So he's going to pull the vinyl out to see what condition the records are in. And when he does, he discovers that there's not vinyl inside. Instead, it was painted cardboard and all of the labels were fake and they had hand-drawn grooves on the cardboard.
Oh, no.
And so what he realizes is Mingering Mike was not a real recording artist, but that someone had made this hugely detailed fantasy. These were handmade fake vinyl records.
Wow.
And so it's 11 years later, the Smithsonian American Art Museum in D.C. has just put on a display of Mingering Mike's fictional music career with about 150 records.
Oh, wow.
So this guy was 5 years old in the 50s. His mother dies of lupus. His father disappears. He goes to a psychiatric hospital, has schizophrenia. And so he's basically raised by his sister. He's super shy. He gets mugged in the 60s. And so he just says, I'm going to go sit in my house, and kind of becomes a recluse. And then he starts drawing and designing these records with himself as an alter ego. So he made cover artwork and started putting these hand-built records inside and spent a couple years in the late 60s designing all of these fake records. He has to go and join the army. He's sent off to Vietnam. He becomes an army deserter. And then in the early 70s, he made 50 albums and about 20 singles. He just makes this huge collection of records. And he basically is hiding out now because he's afraid he's going to be arrested as a Vietnam deserter. All the draft dodgers get pardoned in the late 70s. And then he starts working as a security guard. He puts his albums into storage, but then he misses a payment and the owner auctioned all of his records off to a record seller from the flea market.
Oh.
And that's how Hadar found them.
That's awesome. Yeah, what kind of artwork is he doing? What is he using to make these albums?
It looks like kind of colored pencil. It looks like hand-drawn. Just these like very folk art, kind of primitive, just sentimental, almost childish, beautiful drawings, very colorful. I don't know. It's just amazing. So I had a big show in the Smithsonian Art Museum. They tracked down Mingering Mike, who's still very publicity shy. But I just thought, what a cool, amazing thing to be making, you know, hundreds of fake records about yourself. And then for them to be found in the way that they were found, that's just like too amazing to be true. But I think it is.
Wow. So he came up with the name Mingering Mike is the artist name he came up with?
Yeah, that's his fantasy name. And so he said he was watching a sign, a road sign that said merge. And so he decided to put the word mingle and merge together. And that's how it became Mingering.
Yeah, I needed someone to define that for me. I wasn't sure if it just wasn't in my vocabulary or, you know, what Mingering was.
It's part of his imaginary fantasy world, I think. Yeah, Mingering Mike.
I don't know if I want to be a Mingering person. It doesn't sound quite appropriate to me.
I know, because in England, minging is like something that's disgusting or gross. So that's the kind of connotation you have.
But still, when I was a boy, we invented a comic book. It's called Captain Dave and the Howling Commandos. And I was Captain Dave, and I always had a beard. So I always wanted to someday grow a beard. But it was, in the comic book, it was way better beard than I have now. But I'm doing what I can.
Yeah. Well, if you want to know more about Mingering Mike, Check out MingerandMike.com. He's got a website, and there is, he actually sang some of his songs into a tape recorder, so there's a few actual songs. So he's not just totally fantasy.
Oh, that's like heartwarming and strange at the same time.
Super strange. It's really awesome.
So I have one more thing to add to small talk. If you've been on the internet, you've probably seen people make homes out of shipping containers. You know, these huge ships coming across the ocean. They're loaded with containers. And these people are thinking, like, what do we do when they're all done? And they're getting these shipping containers, making houses. Super interesting. But then somebody took it to the next level, and they made swimming pools with these shipping containers.
Oh, that sounds great.
And, you know, you can get different size shipping containers and stuff, but they made swimming pools. You could put one in your backyard right now. Well, neither of you could, but...
Because we're renting?
Maybe I could. I could put a shipping container and boom, I'm making a swimming pool.
That's really smart. So they're well sealed. You don't have to add any extra sealant, or do you have to seal it?
I think you have to add some extra sealant. There's actually quite a bit of work. Initially, I was super excited. I was like, oh, yeah. I'll make a shipping container pool. And then I started reading about it, and it sounded like you'd actually have to do stuff. So I'm not going to make one, but I still want to. I think you just have to seal it. You've got to, you know, pump in the water, and you've got to be able to filter stuff. But you've got the structure. All you got to do is fill it with water and seal it, and you got a swimming pool.
Yeah. I don't know. Are shipping containers easy to obtain? I don't imagine they're tremendously expensive.
I don't think they're that expensive. I think it depends on how many you kind of want to obtain. I think if you're building a large house with lots of them, it might be an issue. But if you're just grabbing one shipping container to make into your swimming pool, which would be a fantastic lap swimming pool because they're usually quite long and thin, and you could get terrific exercise. Swimming's great exercise, Rosie. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, I didn't. I'm not much of a swimmer.
Wow. Educational, Dave. Teaching us that swimming is good exercise.
Yeah, that's all I have to say. But I got very excited. Shipping container pool, I'm in. And I'm also in on Mingering Mike. And I'm way in on Lonesome Dove. I couldn't be more in. But something that I'm totally out on, that I've never read or really given much thought to, but I'm very excited to hear from you guys, is Walden Pond. So, Rosie, you say that you live pretty close to Walden. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I do. About a 20-minute drive from Concord, Massachusetts, where Walden Pond is, and also, like, the famous revolutionary side of the, you know, Lexington and Concord, see the whites of their eyes.
So for people that don't know or are like me and have actively not known, so why is Walden Pond famous? Why is that something that I should even know about?
Well, Walden Pond, actual title of the book that Henry David Thoreau put together is Walden, semicolon, or Life in the Woods. It's a collection of, they're almost like essays that Henry David Thoreau put together when he decided to build a home on the shores of this Walden Pond in Concord, Massachusetts, and to live there for a couple of years and to learn what he could from life in some solitude and interacting with the natural world.
So I'm assuming you've read this book and have appreciated it. Did you get any kind of feeling when you actually went to the pond?
Yeah, well, I would say it depends on the time of year that you go. So the first time I went there, I did feel that it was very reverent and special, but that was in March, which is a very cold and desolate time of year here in New England. And so we, you know, we're all bundled up and went out to this pond, and there was no one there, and it was quite still and very nice. And that was on a vacation, and I since moved to Boston and live here. And in coming back and visiting in the summer months, it's more of just a recreation site for all sorts of families to picnic and swim and play games. And a lot of them probably have never heard of Thoreau. I mean, they're a bunch of, you know, Jensens, Dave Jensens out there, just hanging out, wondering why they can't have flotation devices or dogs, because they put some rules in place, the Conservation Society, to try to keep it reverent, so I know you can't have any flotation devices.
Here's the thing, Dave.
Yes, I want to hear it.
I just want to make a case for you to read the book, Walden. And I can't speak for Rosie, but for me, This was the most important, most influential, like for me, my favorite book for most of my adult life. I first encountered it in my early teens, and I read it, and Thoreau spoke to me like no one else had spoken to me, really. I just thought, this is it. He's got it. I'm just going to give you a taste here, Dave. At the beginning of the book, he sets out his project because he says, I'm going to go do this experiment. I'm going to go live for a while in Walden. And he says this about it, Dave. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. Come on, Dave, you gotta read that book.
So what's appealing, I assume it appeals to both of you to some extent, what's appealing about that thought of stripping life away and reducing it to its lowest terms?
So for me, there's two things. Like one, I found in Walden, there's all this kind of pointing towards higher wisdom, which was really exciting to me as a teenager and maybe less so now. But it was like part of it was a manual for how to live. Experience really matters. Keep things simple. Don't shun your life no matter how hard it is. Love your life. Live it in the season that you live in. Just be alive in your senses. And that was great, a great message, like a how to live book. But the other thing was this praise of simplicity and of voluntary poverty. And I think at that particular time in my life, I was really becoming aware of like the super conspicuous consumption and the materialism that basically defines our cultural values. And I was kind of disgusted by them. And in Thoreau, I found someone who was saying, you know what, you don't need this stuff. He was deliberately nonconformist and marching to the beat of his own drum, and to say, you know, simplify, 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 strip out the superfluous stuff in your life, because all you need are very, very simple things. And that spoke to me, I think, was why Walden was so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I share the exact same sentiment. The call to simplicity is really what stood out to me and still does. I think later on that same page that Steele read from, he says, our life is frittered away by details. And yeah. I've just found times in my own life where it's just like, what? Like, obviously, like, my days are full and I'm doing all these things, but, like, what am I really accomplishing? You know, how meaningful is this existence? And then I take a Saturday and I just go on a hike all day and I come home and I'm just like, I could die happy. I'm full.
Yeah. I feel like, Rosie, when I talk to people about Walden, I rarely meet someone who really loves or appreciates Walden. I mentioned Thoreau, and people have this idea in their mind of who Thoreau is or was, and it feels so different from my own view of Thoreau's. And you had this great set of questions, like, what view of Thoreau is most accurate?
Right. So I thought of a couple different perspectives on who Thoreau is. Some people might call him a hermit. Some might call him an environmental guru or an anti-slavery crusader. Others would possibly call him an irresponsible layabout, a pacifist, prophet, a pantheist. And I would say that, you know, all of those are, you know, they're taking these ideas of who he is from different sections of this book of Walden. And, you know, they all perhaps have some validity, you know, but I don't know which one represents him most entirely or if any of them do. Dave, you want to take a stab based on your extensive amount of knowledge?
On my limited amount of knowledge, where I would put Thoreau is in the category of a guy who writes a lot of words when really, if he just sums it up in a paragraph, I think I'd be okay with it. That's
so
the general
long-winded
place,
huh?
I put him in. I've never read it.
Like, when you think of Henry David Thoreau, you think of kind of a long-winded blowhard? That's the vision, or that's your kind of sense of who he was?
No, I feel like he probably has a positive message, and I appreciate the message of being in touch with nature. I feel that when I go into nature. I feel a peace, and you get to kind of forget some of these cares of the world. And I think that's an important thing. I think that's something that we should have but I haven't read the book, but just, I think the thing that's kept me from ever looking at it is I feel like I would probably agree with a lot of what he writes, but I just, it feels like to me that he's going to write it in a way where I'm going to not be able to get through it. It's going to be muddled and it's going to be, doesn't feel like it's going to be worth it to me to invest in it.
Sure. So the style is something that's off-putting. I got it.
Yeah.
It's definitely not super accessible. I don't think he wrote it and he didn't know what form the book was going to take. That's kind of why I said, to me, it's almost like this collection of essays.
Yeah, I think you're right, Rosie.
He wrote all these ideas down and all this time over several years. And he said, well, you know, like I could probably put this all together in like a reader friendly version, but I'm just going to slap it all together and put titles on each section and people can dig through it if they want.
It's kind of a mix of journaling and reflections and his accounts, like his financial accounts. It's really a strange hodgepodge with these kind of philosophical meditations interspersed. It's not the same kind of read as a fast-paced novel, for sure.
It feels like it's presenting positive ideas, things that you both of you could very much relate to. Why do you think it has had such a cultural impact when it seems like he kind of pasted it together almost?
For me, it's the quality of the ideas and the way that they find resonance with people of a certain age, like with nonconformists. Like there's something powerful about his commitment to ideals and to principles. I think as well, like for me, he sums up his lesson. And I want you to listen to this, Dave, and tell me if this doesn't sound like maybe the most American thing you've ever heard. He says, I learned this at least by my experiment. He's talking about the 2 years living out there. That if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours.
And that's a beautiful sentiment. I would hope that all Americans, I'd hope everybody carries that in their hearts. I hope I do. But I guess some of his other ideas is it's easy to get distracted by that dream, by those endeavors of life, living them exactly how you'd want because of, I guess, the details, because of all the things that get in your way.
And I feel like basically he's saying you can have what you want as long as what you want is really simple and you're willing to give up the stuff that most normal people want.
Well, do you think that's true?
No, I agree. I made a list of things based on the sections in his book that he essentially says we would do better to live without these things or basically to scale them down as much as possible. And they're things like industry in general. Schedules, commerce, housekeeping, expansion, technology, and news.
Oh, and don't forget, like, cooked food. He's like, he lived on, like, 4 ingredients and, like, a bag of rice fed him, carrots would feed him for several months. So it's like variety and spice and food was not certainly on his high importance list because it was expensive.
Yeah. So they're like substantial things, you know? Like, we need to work less. We need to not worry about commerce. The house doesn't need to be that clean. Like if you're worrying about keeping your house clean when you could be doing something better with your time, just let it be dirty.
You don't need more than 2 shirts, et cetera. Yeah. A job. You don't need a job.
So what should the focus of your life be then? Because many people like those things you just listed, that is life.
Yeah. Frittered away by the details.
So. Yeah, Dave. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation.
Right.
That's what he says. So I don't know. I have also thought, Rosie, if there's time, there's that fill in the blanks exercise you put together.
All right. I thought this would be fun. He goes off on some tangents that, you know, there are some parts that it's just like, oh, great. Now I get to read this humorous section where he talks about his, you know, his bean plants for 30 pages. So this will give you a sense of some of the nice surprises maybe you'll find. All right, so here's a sentence, and I'll read it and then give a blank for Dave to fill in. None is so poor that he needs sit on a blank.
None is so poor that he needs sit on another human being.
It's a critique of slavery. Yeah, you're right, Dave.
Yeah, he was against slavery. So the correct answer is pumpkin.
Yes, I remember that. Nobody's so poor he needs to sit on a pumpkin.
So, like, bare necessities, sounds like a chair. Sounds like a chair makes the list.
Okay.
Here's another one. My enemies are worms, cool days, and most of all, blank.
The Catholics.
Oh, that would be close. That would be close.
Right. So the correct answer is woodchucks. He was talking about his garden in the section.
And he said they were terrible conversationalists as well. He says that a little later in the book.
Yeah, the woodchucks, they caused him hell.
So we want to dedicate small talk to the woodchucks out there.
There are a lot around my house here.
Okay.
I was trying to figure out what they were when I first saw it. My husband and I had a discussion, like, is that a muskrat? Is that a potgut? Like, what is that? And then we decided it was a groundhog. And then we told our neighbor, we have groundhogs in our yard. And he said, oh, you mean the woodchucks? But then I looked it up and they are the same thing. But in New England, you call them woodchucks.
So do they call it Woodchuck Day?
I know.
Is Puxtony Phil a woodchuck?
Maybe. My neighbor he's as New England as they get, so I'll have to run that by him. He will know.
See, Pennsylvania, he probably doesn't even consider it part of the U.S. It's too far west.
All right, I got another good one. And if blank are not built, how shall we get to heaven in season?
And if blank are not built, how should we get to heaven? And if... I'm having difficulty with this, but I'm going to do it. I have a good feeling for Thoreau. I feel like I understand him a little bit more now. And if skyscrapers are not built, how shall we get to heaven in season?
It's railroads, yeah?
Railroads.
You got the right sentiment there. I don't know how many skyscrapers there were in the 1840s, but he really hated the railroads.
Yeah, because men don't ride on the railroads, Dave. Railroads ride upon men.
Right.
That's rough.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't like the expansion they were causing.
And the noise, all the noise and the smoke and the speed and the haste. What a waste.
I mean, what is so negative to him about this expansion, about this industrialism? I mean, there can be cases made that is very positive, that having the railroads could be a very positive thing. Obviously, that's what a lot of our culture and modern America is built on, is industry.
You got to read the book to find out, Dave. We're not going to do your work for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last one. I got up early and blank. That was a religious exercise and one of the best things I did.
Well, if it's me and I'm in nature, I know exactly how I fill in the blank. I got up early and I greeted the morning with the poop.
Yes! I was so hoping you would say that, Dave. I knew that was what it would be.
Oh, man. No, that's not right. He got up early and bathed in a pond, in his near Walden Pond. That was a religious exercise and one of the best things which he did.
Well, on this point, I'm going to have to disagree with Thoreau. If you're in the desert and the sun's just rising, you climb to the top of the highest hill there, you dig a hole, and you take care of business. And it is a religious exercise. And it's going to be the best thing you do all day.
It's just downhill from there, huh?
You didn't know much about the desert. That would have taken a ride on a train.
All right. So thanks for sharing those thoughts about Walden. I don't know if you guys convinced me to read the book or not. But I would watch a short film if they produced one.
I can't believe what that film would be like.
It would not be short. That is.
No, it's true. Oh, man. What if they made an action film about Walden? That would be incredible.
I could write it right now. I'm ready. So far, we've talked about nature. I think we've talked about some beautiful places. And for this week on Unchained Melodies, we wanted to discuss some songs that make you feel like it's summer. I'll go first. A song that just makes me think of summer, makes me think of getting in the car and just going on a great American road trip. That's Windfall by Sunvolt.
Now and then it keeps you running, never seems to die. Trails spent with fear, not enough, living on the outside. Never seem to get far enough, staying in between the lines. Hold on to what you can, waiting for the end, not knowing when. May the wind take your troubles away,
a feel-good song. That's really nice, Dave. What a voice. Is that Jay Farrar?
That is. I love his voice, and Ariane, my wife, hates his voice. No longer listen to Sunvolt in my household, but I still have to sneak it in sometimes. So what do you got, Rosie? Summer. What's for summer?
Right. Well, I would say one of the best things about summer is swimming. And this song by Loudon Wainwright III, called The Swimming Song, kind of captures the beauty of swimming on a summer's day.
This summer.
That's great. That does feel like summer. That's a happy summer. I would join him for where he's going swimming. I'd jump in.
Yeah, he talks about the reservoir, the lake. He'll remind you about some, different strokes you can use while you're swimming.
So it's instructive as well, not just...
I love Loudon Wainwright. Great choice, great song, great songwriter. Good summer song. So, Dave, since you guys both picked kind of folky songs there to start with, I have one in the same vein. This is by a group from North Carolina called the Bowerbirds, and this is a song that makes me just feel in love and happy in summertime. It's called Overcome with Light.
And how I know I'm happy now, I'll jump right down the chutes of time. And yes, the weather was not always great, but the furrow always graced my brow. Now I'm overcome with light, overcome with light. Overcome with light, overcome with light. Yes, we had some hard work, but now it's right. Overcome with light, overcome.
Liked it.
Yeah, I've listened to him a little bit. I like the vocal harmonies that they do. It's always nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to shatter the mood here with some real summer songs. So, guys, Fountains of Wayne, they're from New Jersey. They wrote probably the greatest song ever written about having a crush on your friend's mom, Stacy's mom. I don't think you can do better than that. But even better, before they had their big hit, their first album was just terrific. We're going back to the 90s. I think I'm going to go with Leave the Biker here.
Oh, good choice,
awesome
Dave.
Song.
Seems the further from town I go, the more I hate this place. He's got leather and big tattoos, scars all over his face. And I wonder if he ever has cried, cause he couldn't get a date for the prom. He's got his arm around every man's dream. Crumbs in his beard from the seafood special. Oh, can't you see my world is falling apart? Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart.
It's just fun. I mean, summer should be fun, and those guys are fun.
Said summer should be fun. I think it also should be hot and sunny. I was thinking about, I thought this song was related to summer because it's called Mad at the Clouds by Crash, who's one of the members of Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros. Yeah, this is just for those days when the clouds are out and it just should be hot and sunny, but you got to get through it.
Just keep cooling down your bones for me. I can't be there and back again, but I'm still here. And I walked all alone today. For if I come, you best be in touch with the clouds.
I like that choice, Rosie. That it's got that kind of dreamy California surf guitar with those really nice vocals over the top.
Nice song.
And all the best summers should be actually spent in California. So that's good.
Speaking of which, Dave, there's my last choice. This is by a band called The Drums, and it's called Let's Go Surfing.
Yeah, I want to go surfing. I'm in.
The thing I love most about that song, I think they're saying, oh, bummer, but I always imagine they're saying Obama. So they're like singing this song to President Obama, like telling him they want to go surfing. So that's how we sing it in our house. And that's dedicated to you, Rosie, because of your shirt today.
Like it.
Obama, I want to go surfing. Anyway.
It seems like Obama would enjoy it. I think he'd have a good time surfing with those guys.
For sure.
Let's close this up. I know that Rosie likes books and enjoys reading. She's got some book wisdom that she's going to lay down on us.
Yeah, I don't know how much wisdom, but I just, I've been listening to the show and I just feel that it's been needing a little more Kurt Vonnegut. And so I could give some background on this excerpt, but I'm not really going to. It's just a story within a story that puts you inside the brilliant mind of satirist and pacifist intellectual Kurt Vonnegut. So, from Cat's Cradle. I once knew an Episcopalian lady in Newport, Rhode Island, who asked me to design and build a doghouse for her Great Dane. The lady claimed to understand God and his ways of working perfectly. She could not understand why anyone should be puzzled about what had been or what was going to be. And yet when I showed her a blueprint of the doghouse I proposed to build, she said to me, "I'm sorry, but I never could read one of those things." "Give it to your husband or your ministers to pass on to God," I said. "And when God finds a minute, I'm sure he'll explain this doghouse of mine in a way that even you can understand." She fired me. I shall never forget her. She believed that God liked people in sailboats much better than he liked people in motorboats. She could not bear to look at a worm. When she saw a worm, she screamed. She was a fool, and so am I. And so is anyone who thinks he sees what God is doing.
So, so good, Rosie. What a fantastic choice. That is my favorite of all the Kurt Vonnegut novels, actually.
Likewise.
When I was in high school, I don't know where I heard that Kurt Vonnegut was great, but somewhere I heard it, and so I decided, you know, you have these little obsessions when you're teenagers, and it was Kurt Vonnegut for me. I read everything that Kurt Vonnegut had written to that point, and Cat's Cradle was unforgettable. So good.
Yeah, it is great.
Rosie, it has been fantastic having you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here.
And we would love to have you back on sometime soon after Dave has read Walden, and he can finally apologize and tell us how right we all were.
Right. That day will come.
I hope so. Enjoy Medford. We will talk again soon.
All right. Bye, Steele.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Off the chain. It's off the chain. Welcome to this world. It's off the chain.
I I need a profile picture, I guess. It's embarrassing. I'm sorry, guys.
I just see a blue stick person.
Man, that's what I see when I look in the mirror as well. Regardless of what I do soon. So I may just, like, disappear.